headlines, Moscow said it is taking control of a city in southern Ukraine, while Kiev claims some 6,000 Russian troops have lost their lives during the 7-day conflict. President Biden bans Russian flights from U.S. skies, blaming Russia's President Vladimir Putin for the anti-Moscow sanctions. And Iran says its bitter experience with U.S. non-compliance and Europe's inaction has prompted Tehran to push for a reliable and sustainable agreement in the Vienna talks. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour. It's the 7th day of Russia's military operation in Ukraine, with major cities, including the capital Kiev, being the target of attacks. Clashes have erupted in the northeastern city of Kharkiv, where Russian airborne troops have landed. Authorities say 4 people were killed this morning as the city was hit with rockets and air raids. Meanwhile, in the capital Kiev, an airstrike on the main television tower has killed 5 people. Russian forces have also taken full control of the regional center of the Black Sea city of Kherson. In fresh remarks, Ukraine's president has claimed almost 6,000 Russians have lost their lives during the ongoing conflict. So far, there's been no reaction to that from Russian officials. Volodymyr Zelensky has said Moscow cannot win the war with bombs and rockets, but Russia's defense minister earlier pledged to push ahead with the operation until all the objectives are achieved. Hours ago, U.S. President Joe Biden delivered his first State of the Union address to Congress. The conflict between Russia and Ukraine was the primary theme of his speech, during which he pledged that the West will be all united in the face of the Russian attack on Ukraine.
He thought he could divide us at home, in this chamber, in this nation. He thought he could divide us in Europe as well. But Putin was wrong. We are ready. We are united, and that's what we did. We stayed united.
Biden had some tough words for President Vladimir Putin, accusing him of launching a premeditated and unprovoked war on Ukraine. He called Putin a dictator and said that he'll pay a continuing high price over the long run. Biden said Washington, with the help of its allies, is inflicting economic pain on Russia, and even announced a ban on Russian flights.
We're joining with European allies to find and seize their yachts, their luxury apartments, their private jets. We're coming for you, ill-begotten gains. And tonight, I'm announcing that we will join our allies in closing off American airspace to all Russian flights, further isolating Russia and adding additional squeeze on their economy.
Biden also said, and these are his own words, that Washington is choking off Russia's access to technology that will sap its economic strength and weaken its military for years to come. The U.S. president blamed his Russian counterpart for the anti-Moscow sanctions and claimed that Putin has never been so isolated. Biden said the conflict with Ukraine will leave Russia weaker and the rest of the world stronger. Russia's military operation in Ukraine is rattling global markets, with oil prices surging to 7-year highs amid supply disruption fears over the economic sanctions on Moscow. Brent crude oil has surged past $110 per barrel. Also, U.S. West Texas Intermediate crude is up by 5% at above $108. OPEC and other major producers, including Russia, will hold a meeting to discuss increasing output to control price rises. On Tuesday, the International Energy Agency, which includes the U.S., agreed to release 60 million barrels of crude reserves to try and curb soaring prices. But a disruption from Russia, one of the world's top oil suppliers, could send prices even higher. Also, Asian stocks declined as investors fretted about the impact of sanctions on Russia. Observers are concerned that the disruption caused by the sanctions could have a deep negative impact on global growth and inflation. And the first Ukrainian refugees have started arriving in Italy after Russia launched a military operation in Ukraine last week. Meanwhile, African refugees have been pushed back when trying to cross the border with Poland. Here's a report on that.
The first refugees fleeing from conflict-stricken Ukraine have arrived in northern Italy as Europe braces, the media are saying, for a major humanitarian crisis. So far, arriving refugees, who mostly comprise women, children and the elderly, have been registered in 4 Italian regions, namely Trentino, Veneto, Emilia-Romagna and Friuli-Venezia Giulia. In addition, scores of African-born expats have joined hundreds of thousands of people who are trying to escape Europe. Ukraine and cross into Poland and other neighboring countries. Reports have emerged suggesting that many black refugees have been subjected to racist and unfair treatment at the border with Poland.
Africans are being stopped from leaving Ukraine because of the color of their skin. It is shocking. It brings us back to the dark age of racism and intolerance against black people. I'm disgusted. Also because the media here in Italy do not cover these stories as they should.
Nigeria and South Africa have denounced such discrimination, calling on border officials in Ukraine and its neighbors to treat their nationals equally. About 30,000 Africans, mostly from Nigeria, Morocco and Egypt, reside in Ukraine. They make up more than 20% of Ukraine's international students, attracted by the country's good technical and medical schools, combined with relatively low fees.
It is a basic principle in international refugee law, as well as in all human rights law, the principle of non-discrimination, a basic principle which has to be observed by all states, also here, certainly by Poland, Ukraine and the other countries around Ukraine.
The Italian government has recently agreed to redistribute Ukrainian refugees across the European Union. Italy will likely receive 13% of the total allocation. On Tuesday, Prime Minister Mario Draghi said, while reporting to the Senate on the Ukraine crisis, that, quote, Russia's invasion of Ukraine is a decisive turning point in European history. Max Civili, Rome.
Iran says the bitter experience it's had with the U.S. non-compliance and Europe's inaction regarding the 2015 agreement has prompted it to push for a reliable and sustainable deal in the Vienna talks. Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, made those comments during a meeting with a number of lawmakers. Shamkhani said in addition to putting forth efforts to remove the sanctions, Iran is also focusing its strategy on neutralizing the effects of those sanctions. The lawmakers present at the session also called for the Iranian negotiating team to keep pushing so that a possible final agreement would compensate the Iranian people for the losses they've incurred. Elsewhere, U.S. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham's latest comments about Iranian nuclear scientists is drawing outrage from Iranian officials. Tehran's permanent representative to the U.N. describes the remarks as provocative and terror-inciting. Majid Takht-Ravanchi says Graham's comments are an invitation to additional terrorist acts against Iranian scientists. The U.N. ambassador described the remarks as repulsive, abhorrent, and reprehensible. He said such rhetoric only serves as a green light to the Israeli regime to perpetrate more terrorist acts against Iranian nuclear scientists. In an interview in mid-February, Graham said a lot of Iranian scientists have had a lot of accidents, adding the U.S. would expect even more accidents to come. Several Iranian scientists have been assassinated in Israeli terrorist operations in Iran, the last one being Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who lost his life in a targeted killing near Tehran in November 2020. But we're going to go back to our previous story, where Iran says the bitter experience that it's had with the U.S.'s noncompliance and Europe's inaction regarding the 2015 agreement has prompted it to push for a reliable and sustainable deal in the Vienna talks. Those are recent comments made by Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani. Malazi joining us now from the Vienna, from the Austrian capital, Vienna, to offer us more. Homa, welcome to the program. What can you tell us about where the negotiations, at what stage they are right now, and also walk us through the recent comments made by Mr. Shamkhani?
Fadia, the talks are still ongoing. They're continuing. We had last night intensive discussions that we're hearing lasted until 1 a.m. in the morning between Iran and representatives of the three European signatories of the JCPOA, Britain, France, and Germany. Various members of the delegations were posting photos and still images of that meeting until the very late hours of last night. And those photos showing, in a sense, giving an idea of what goes on behind those closed doors, discussions between the Iranians themselves separately, and then separate discussions between the Europeans. And then they're on both sides of the table, going back, discussing the remaining issues. And this morning, we even had more pictures of the three European countries with the EU coordinator and with the U.S. Representative Rob Maddie, again making these intensive discussions while they were having a walk just outside the premises of the Hotel Coburg. And now we're hearing that these negotiations between Iran and the Europeans are still continuing behind me in the Coburg. So what are they focused on? Of course, the outstanding remaining issues, which are, as far as we've been told, both by Iranians and other sources, the issue of sanctions, the sanctions that Iran wants to be removed, as well as guarantees, the economic, political and legal guarantees that Iran is looking for. And of course, the issue of the IAEA probe into Iran's past activities. Iranian officials and sources making it clear that it is vital for this team to have that issue closed, because they do not want it to be used, in the words of one political analyst, as a loophole to take the JCPOA hostage when it comes to implementation. They want to have all the necessary assurances and guarantees that if the JCPOA is going to be implemented.
Thanks a lot, Toma Lezgi, joining us from the Austrian capital, Vienna. Moving on, the fuel crisis in Yemen is taking its toll on the economy. A Yemeni official has talked about the causes and repercussions of the crisis. Amr al-Azrai, the executive director of the Yemeni oil company, says the problem is rooted in the U.S.-backed Saudi-led coalition that's preventing the entry of fuel tankers into the port of Hodeidah. He says this resulted in $600 million worth of damage to Yemen's economy last year alone. He says blocking fuel from reaching civilians is a crime and would threaten their lives. He also slammed the UN for remaining silent on this. Al-Azrai made the remarks in an interview with Al Alam News Channel. Since the beginning of the Saudi war on Yemen 7 years ago, the kingdom has maintained an all-out blockade on the country, depriving millions of civilians of their basic rights. And Israeli forces have killed at least 3 Palestinians in the past 24 hours. The killings come just more than a week after a 14-year-old boy was killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed the recent tensions in the occupied Palestine. Let's see what our guests had to say about that.
Welcome, everyone, to the News Review program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. Now, Israeli forces killed a third Palestinian in the West Bank in less than 24 hours as tensions run high in occupied territories. Amar Shafiq Abu Afifa was shot dead near the city of Bethlehem. Israeli forces are refusing to hand over his body to Palestinians. Earlier in the day, Israeli forces killed 2 other Palestinians in a raid on the Jenin refugee camp. Tuesday was declared a day of rage in Palestine, with demonstrations held across the occupied West Bank in solidarity with prisoners languishing in Israeli jails. Joining us now for the program is Robert Fantina, author and journalist from Kitchener, Ontario, and Lawrence Davison, former lecturer out of Westchester University, joining us from Westchester, Pennsylvania. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess, Lawrence Davison, we'll start with you. Hope you're safe and doing well. Now, Israeli forces have killed 3 Palestinian protesters over the last day. My question to you, we don't hear anything about it out of the international community. We don't hear about the guy with the big guns taking advantage of the guy with little guns or no guns taking his land. But we hear an awful lot about Russia with the big guns going in against a beleaguered military there in the Ukrainian army. And everybody's hearts are supposed to pour out for, Ukrainians. Why not Palestinians?
There was a host on one of the programs of MSNBC who actually came out on the air and said that American credibility in this case is not very good because of the hypocrisy, one of which, of course, is that we support, the taking of land as long as the people who are taking it as our allies. When it comes to the shootings, I think it's very important to understand that these shootings are not just individual soldiers acting out, but these shootings essentially are policy. The soldiers know that they're not going to be punished. And so what we've got here is a unwritten yet official policy that if you think that you can get a good shot at a Palestinian demonstrator, you take it. And it's not only an unwritten but official policy of the army, but it's a publicly supported policy too. I think that the bulk of the Israeli the Jewish Israeli population doesn't care. I mean, so these guys can shoot anybody they want, and they're sort of semi-heroes.
Robert, I mean, Vladimir Putin can turn over to Joe Biden, Emmanuel Macron, any of the Western leaders, and basically just say one word: Israel. You can't tell me anything until you address the fact that Israel. It's a precedent. You guys, whatever we've done over the last 5 or 6 days, Israel's, been doing for the last 70 some odd years with your veto power, with your green light, with your arms onto Palestinians. You have nothing you can say to us.
It's the truth. It's complete hypocrisy when the United States and other countries, NATO countries, are condemning Russia for doing the very same things that Israel does on a regular basis and has, as you said, for decades, and with complete support of these same people same governments that are condemning Russia for its actions now. It's completely hypocritical. The violation of international law is violation of international law regardless of who's committing it. However, in the eyes of many Western nations, it's not quite so bad if Israel's violated, despite the horrific suffering that the Palestinian people undergo on a daily basis. This is ongoing. This is the techniques that Israel uses to not only to kill and torture Israel, Palestine, but to demoralize them, to degrade them, to strip them of their dignity. These are abominable and shocking behaviors that are well known, they're well documented, and yet the United States and most European countries simply look the other way, continue to trade with Israel, continue to support Israel, and when Israel is bombing Gaza, restricting people in checkpoints throughout the West Bank.
All right, gentlemen, stay safe, both of you. Thanks for joining us on the program. Robert Fantina from out of Kitchener, Ontario, and Lawrence Davidson there joining us from Westchester, Pennsylvania. That brings us to the end of your news review program. Thanks for tuning in, and bye-bye for now. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints. همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of a speech delivered on February 17, 2022 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participation of people from Tabriz and East Azerbaijan, commemorating the anniversary of the Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
If Tabriz had not made that great move on February 18th, the tradition of holding 40-day commemorations and continuing the battle would not have started and become common for the Iranian nation. When the 40-day ceremony of the martyrs of Qom was commemorated in Tabriz on the initiative of the people there, it became a model. In various other cities in Yazd, in Kerman, in cities of Fars province, and in various other areas, this movement started, and it brought the people to the arena of revolutionary activities, and therefore the presence of the people led to the victory of revolution. The victory of the revolution was due to the presence of the people in the arena and in the streets. This revolution was won neither by guns, nor by political games, nor by partisanship. It was won with the presence of the people, and the presence of the people was due to these movements, movements which started and were initiated in Tabriz. Therefore, all of us, including your dear people of Tabriz, should thank God that your move was blessed and led to the victory of the revolution.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Well, the February 18th Tabriz uprising is an event. Azerbaijan has gone through various events and throughout history from a few centuries ago onwards, as much as we can boldly say, from 3 or 4 centuries ago onwards, Azerbaijan has been a promoter of national unity and national resistance. In other words, Azerbaijan and Tabriz were a key point for the unity of the Iranian nation and an important center for training the Iranian people to withstand various incidents. This leads to great honors for this city and this province. Of course, the 29th of Bahman is a great honor for East Azerbaijan and Tabriz themselves. Another point which deserves mention is that one of the great advantages of Azerbaijan is that the flag of devotion to the Ahlul Bayt has always been in the hands of the Azerbaijan people.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Fires in Greece, Turkey, the United States. Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
North Korea says it launched a missile on Sunday as part of developing a reconnaissance satellite system. The North has not elaborated on the type of rocket used in the test, but authorities in South Korea say it appeared to be a ballistic missile, fired from an area near Pyongyang toward the sea off its east coast. The launch was the eighth this year and the first since the end of January when North Korea fired off a record number of projectiles, including its longest-range ballistic missile since 2017. North Korea has ramped up its missile testing in 2022, announcing plans to bolster its defenses against the United States and evaluating restarting all suspended military activities. North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un had previously stated that his country's weapons development is necessary for self-defense in the face of hostile policies from the United States, including sanctions and joint military drills with South Korea. The North has also vowed to strengthen its nuclear capabilities by building more powerful atomic weapons. The exact size and strength of North Korea's nuclear arsenal are unclear. Some estimates say North Korea could have around 200 nuclear weapons by 2027. Pyongyang is believed to have tested nuclear weapons several times. It has also tested ballistic projectiles capable of reaching the United States. But why does North Korea need this expanding military program?
They learned their lesson, in essence. They learned that the United States can't be trusted, and it is willing to commit just horrific crimes against the Korean people to secure its own interests. And so North Korea doesn't want to end up the same way that Iraq is, the way Palestine is, the way Afghanistan is, because of U.S. involvement, U.S. intervention.
Meanwhile, the U.S. Indo-Pacific Command said it was consulting with its allies, South Korea and Japan, about the latest test. The command said in a statement that the U.S. condemns the launch and calls on North Korea to refrain from further, quote, destabilizing acts. Following a series of North Korean missile launches, the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has imposed sanctions against Pyongyang. Washington has also called on the Security Council to take action against several North Korean individuals and entities accused of violating resolutions that ban North Korea's projectiles and nuclear weapons development. North Korean citizens continue to suffer because of the sanctions. The World Food Program has estimated that 10.1 million North Koreans are suffering from food shortages. Also, the UN has acknowledged that the US-backed sanctions were at least partly responsible for North Korea's food and medicine shortages.
The US sanctions against Korea have been devastating. It has significantly hurt the living standard of the people in North Korea. But with that in mind, they have pushed forward. They have continued on despite the difficult situation that they've been dealt because of U.S. foreign policy. You see that in their scientific advancements. You see that in their rebuilding of the nation after the Korean War. And you're seeing that now as they continue. Since the Trump administration continue to build newer and improve upon previous models of nuclear warheads.
Despite the sanctions, North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un is pursuing a plan for developing weapons that included hypersonic weapons, spy satellites, solid-fuel intercontinental ballistic missiles, and submarine-launched nuclear projectiles. Kim has intensified expanding his country's military capabilities since his diplomacy with former United States President Donald Trump ended without an agreement in 2019.
Well, I certainly hope that the U.S. is serious about improving relations, but I highly doubt it. I think perhaps the first thing that could be done is the U.S. removing its forces from South Korea, because you have to recognize that in a lot of ways, the Republic of Korea or South Korea is just a staging ground for U.S. and NATO forces to be right there on the demilitarized border of North Korea. And so if the U.S. is serious about improving relations, it should, in my opinion, completely withdraw from South Korea, all forces.
Trump took unprecedented steps by initiating several rounds of dialogue with the North. However, Washington blew what Pyongyang called a golden opportunity. The United States, Britain, Europe, and Canada moved to block certain Russian banks' access to the SWIFT international payment system as part of more sanctions against Moscow as it continues its military operation against Ukraine.
We are resolved to continue imposing massive costs on Russia, costs that will further isolate Russia from the international financial system and our economies.
The measures, which will also include restrictions on the Russian Central Bank's international reserves, will be implemented in the coming days.
We will paralyze the assets of Russia's central bank. This will freeze its transactions, and it will make it impossible for the central bank to liquidate assets.
Von der Leyen said removing Russia from SWIFT will paralyze Russia's international trade and effectively stop its imports and exports. Earlier, Berlin announced it has agreed to limit Moscow's access to SWIFT as well. The SWIFT system is a Belgian cooperative that offers many services in assisting businesses and individuals to complete seamless and accurate business transactions. Western countries have joined the chorus as well. The U.S. says Western nations will also impose restrictive measures on the Russian Central Bank to prevent it from deploying its international reserves in ways that undermine the impact of sanctions. But how much damage will these sanctions have on the fragile global economy? The sanctions add to the economic impact of this crisis and will transmit primarily through energy prices as well as grain prices. Russia and Ukraine supply crops to a long list of countries around the world, including large volumes to buyers in the Middle East and Africa. Sanctions will also add to a growing concern of inflation. This could throw the EU economy into mayhem or even negatively affect Russia's gas supplies to Europe. The EU is Russia's biggest trade partner. Nearly 38% of Russia's exports went to the EU, while over 36% of Russia's imports came from Europe. Russia is also the origin of 26% of the EU's oil imports and 40% of the EU's gas imports. The world energy market and commodities have been affected and will continue to witness price surges, especially when it comes to oil. On Thursday, oil prices briefly topped $100 for the first time since 2014. The U.S. and several of its allies, including the European Union and the United Kingdom, have vowed to impose further restrictions on Moscow as punishment. In total, the sanctions will keep approximately $1 trillion in Russian banking assets from flowing through the markets of the U.S. and its partners' financial systems. The sanctions also limit tech exports to Russia and squeeze the country's tech industry. Those sanctions are the main foreign policy tool of Americans. The effectiveness of this tactic is debated. The sanctions already announced are significant in size and scope, but the long-time American reliance on sanctions has left the U.S. with few other options if Russia does not respond. Experts say Russia's sanctions are a big deal, but it could take quite a while, even years, for the sanctions to hurt the Russian economy.
They think they can destroy Russia and China by cutting them off. They cannot. It's a false dream, and it unfortunately, if they continue, it probably will lead to war, perhaps nuclear war, and the annihilation of the human race.
Russian officials dismiss Western sanctions as ineffective. Russia's GDP has grown yet at a slow rate since the West imposed financial sanctions on Russia in 2014. The country's officials also point to low inflation, the minimal budget deficit, a public debt of only 18% of GDP at the end of 2020, steady current account surpluses, and international currency reserves of $596 billion at the end of 2020.
Russians have got used to sanctions and therefore adapted their economy to them.
Almost 2 years after African-American George Floyd died beneath the knee of a white police officer on a street in Minneapolis, the police officers involved are being brought to account. A federal jury has found three former officers present at the scene of Floyd's arrest guilty of depriving the man of his civil rights. The jury found the conduct of the three officers led to Floyd's death, a charge that would impact the final verdict the officers will face. The three are convicted of failing to stop Derek Chauvin, who knelt on Floyd's neck for about 9 minutes, and denying Floyd's constitutional right to medical care while in custody. Tu Tao, Alexander Quang, and Thomas Lane will remain free on bail until their hearings, which aren't scheduled yet. What's for certain is that they'll face several years in prison. Chauvin, the officer arresting Floyd, was sentenced to 22 and a half years last year. For Floyd's family, it's not enough.
This is just accountability. It can never be justice because I can never get George back. And no matter how many times that I pray at night and I think about my brother 24/7, it still is going to be hard, even though we just had a federal conviction and we already had the state conviction. But times, you know, will be probably a lot harder for me still because I can't get my brother back.
The trials are considered historic in the U.S., where officers are hardly ever indicted for the treatment of the members of the black community. Racism in the United States dates back as long as its history. The African Americans have suffered tremendous atrocities at the hands of white slave owners over the years, and the impact it made on American society can be observed to this day. One of the early cases of police racism can be traced back to the early 1700s when South Carolina launched America's first law enforcement force, dubbed the Slave Patrol. As the title suggests, the patrols were tasked with hunting down black people and selling them into slavery. Following a devastating civil war, slavery in the U.S. was abolished in 1865, but the results the anti-slavery camp was looking for didn't come to pass. Wealthy plantation owners in the South found loopholes in the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution and created what later became known as the Black Codes, the rules and regulations that appeared to have acknowledged the abolition but created the same slavery conditions in essence. Among the many racist provisions in the codes is the criminalization of vagrancy for black people. This meant that law enforcement was free to arrest and charge any black person who didn't have a job. The codes were a precursor to Jim Crow laws, which enforced racial segregation in the South and lasted until the mid-20th century. The recent killings and mistreatment of the black people are reminiscent of the lynching of African Americans and the destruction of their properties by the Ku Klux Klan and other hate groups throughout the years.
So I guess the main root is, you know, this country has is founded on a system of white supremacy, racism, and genocide. It's founded on a system of inequality with a purpose, right? Racism with a purpose. The purpose is to create a group of second class citizens who the country can feed off of, right? We can feed off of their labor. We can feed off of their work. We can feed off of their existence.
U.S. President Joe Biden staked much of his presidency on a promise to fight racism in the country, managing to garner the support from a large portion of the African-American society. But with many lawmakers balking at even the idea of police reforms, can the president make good on his pledge?
You know, police reform and police brutality is a big issue for black and brown folks and for poor and working class folks here in the United States. But the U.S. politicians don't represent those people or those interests in this country. They represent a rich interest, the interest of the ruling class. And so, you know, they're not interested in police reform. So this bill, you know, essentially has died in the Senate, and will probably never get passed because of the fact that, you know, there's no interest by U.S. policymakers to get it passed. There's no interest to do what the citizens want them to do.
George Floyd wasn't the first African-American who lost his life over what could otherwise be considered as an inconsequential offense for a white person, and certainly has not been the last. But the waves of scrutiny such cases bring up in their wake are indeed making a positive, albeit limited, impact.
Vienna's Palais Coburg Hotel, the venue of marathon talks between Iran and the P4+1 group. It has once again become the center of a lot of attention as parties involved in the tough negotiations have signaled significant progress despite the complexity of some issues. The eighth round, which began on December 27th, has now become one of the longest rounds of talks between Iran and the P4+1, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany. Iran and the P4+1 are completing a draft text of an agreement to revive the 2015 deal. Most of the delegations acknowledge that the talks have reached a critical stage. The diplomacy seems to be approaching a make-or-break moment. Iran's lead negotiator says being near the finish line does not guarantee crossing it. Ali Bagheri-Kani says it requires extra caution, much perseverance, additional creativity, and a balanced approach to take the last step. The Iranian diplomat points out that to finish the job, there are certain decisions that the Western parties to the negotiations need to take.
Thus far, the West has been reluctant to make any sweeping political decisions that are necessary to bring the United States back into the plan. Iran isn't just going to forget the very many U.S. and Western provocations since the United States left the plan in 2018, and they understand that there are many political camps competing at once for power. The West needs to make sweeping political decisions that will definitively outline the future of U.S. involvement in the plan.
Iran says its initiatives pave the way for the progress in the negotiations and that a good deal is within reach in the Austrian capital. Tehran believes that the ball is now in the West's court, and if it shows serious determination, a good deal can emerge. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi says Tehran seeks a lasting deal, not a fragile one. The president has noted that credible guarantees, putting an end to political claims and effective removal of sanctions are necessary for a lasting deal with the P4+1 group. But what are the characteristics of a lasting deal? The 2015 deal lasted a few years only. Even during the years that the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action was in place, Iran had serious grievances about its implementation by Western parties. It complained that it was not receiving the economic benefits it was entitled to. And Iran seems to have learned a lesson from how the hard-earned international agreement unraveled. Since the beginning of the talks in Vienna last year, Iran has insisted that America must remove all sanctions imposed on Tehran after former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally pulled out from the deal in May 2018 in a verifiable manner. It has also demanded that Washington provide guarantees that it will not leave the JCPOA again.
Iran wants credible guarantees from the United States because the U.S. has failed to provide any critical guarantees, any credible guarantees, since the beginning of these negotiations. When the JCPOA was first being planned and negotiated back in 2015, the United States made a commitment to diplomacy and peace. Yet, in 2018, they proved that that commitment was not a guarantee by dropping out after the change of an administration. So what we find is that when Iran is talking to the United States and other Western nations that change their administrations often, and those administrations are subject to changing their positions from the last administration, then you find that Iran doesn't have any solid guarantees.
Iran says America's maximum pressure campaign has failed and its credibility has been seriously deterred. Observers believe Washington now has to take measures to compensate for its past mistakes and regain the trust of the international community.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wasalam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim عليه السلام.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى ابن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. And Imam Musa al-Kadhim was the seventh divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, Peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim was the son of the sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ja'far ibn Muhammad as-Sadiq alayhi salam. Now, when we talk about Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam, we see historically that he left an amazing legacy full of goodness, righteousness, beauty, and he was a brilliant guide for the community in general. And among the unique aspects that marked Imam al-Kadhim's personality is his steadfastness and determination, his perseverance in front of the difficult events and the ordeals showered upon him by his contemporary tyrants. Old and young have an amazing opportunity to learn to how to deal with life's difficulties by looking into the life of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام إن العاقل رضي بالدون من الدنيا مع الحكمة ولم يرضى بالدون من الحكمة مع الدنيا فلذلك ربحت تجارتهم.
إمام موسى الكاظم عليه السلام stated, Verily the man of intellect contents himself with less worldly things when accompanied with wisdom, and does not content himself with less wisdom and more worldly things. And this is why their trade of the transient for permanent profits him.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, we find in the beautiful golden conversations of this divinely appointed Imam, Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam, we find that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam spoke to his companions in these conversations about certain principles and certain tenets of Islam, and tenets that if one lives by them, they will attain true salvation. In one instance, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam ordered his companions to speak the truth and to show the truth, and likewise to refrain from falsehood. Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam responded to his companions and said, Fear Allah and say the truth, though therein is your destruction, for in reality therein is your salvation. Also and so, fear Allah and leave falsehood, though therein is your salvation, for in reality therein is your destruction. In this conversation, dear friends, that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam has with his companions, he tells them in the first part of the conversation, of course, to fear Allah and to say the truth, even though your destruction seems to be there. Now, this destruction is a superficial destruction. It means you might lose your job or you might lose your status, your position. You might incur a loss in the apparent and the manifest and the zahir level. But Imam al-Kadhim says that when you say the truth, even though apparently it might seem that you are going to lead to your destruction, in reality you are leading to your salvation. And then in the second part, again he says, fear Allah. But this time he talks about falsehood. And Imam al-Kadhim says that one must leave falsehood, even though manifestly or openly or apparently In the outer form, it might seem like you are going to attain salvation, but in reality, it is going to lead to your destruction. So sometimes we think that if we lie or we create or support some sort of falsehood, that we might be able to save ourselves or attain some kind of material or physical salvation. But in reality, falsehood will always lead to destruction, and truth will always lead to salvation. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Kadhim, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
In Islamic ethics, we are told there are two powerful emotions that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given to us. There are two emotions which are considered to be the basis of every other emotion that we have in our system. One is known as ghazab, anger, and this is where al-kadhimul ghayz refers to. But there is other side of it. The second emotion is known as shahwat, desire, greed. Just as we have to restrain and control the emotion which is known as ghadab and anger, similarly, and this is where I would like to slightly digress, but inspired from the title of the Imam, talk about the other side of it. That when it comes to the issue of shahwat, the desire that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has created within us, that is not to be totally suppressed. It can be fulfilled, but the balance is that it should be fulfilled within the bounds of the Islamic Sharia. And when we look at this issue, you know, normally the ulama of akhlaq, they talk about shahwat in two forms. This is just a very general division that we are doing. One is on the issue of food and drinks, and the other is as far as the sexual desires are concerned. We have to restrain. Nobody says, Islam says that don't eat and drink. No. We have to eat and drink. But we should see, is it halal and tayyib or not? Is it halal and healthy or not? Similarly, when we talk about the issue of sexual desires, we have to make sure that it is fulfilled according to the ways in which Islam has allowed it. And the rulings and the teachings are very clear about this issue.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Egypt's prisons. It's not strange for Israel, nor America, nor some European nations that are colonialist to enlist some of the Palestinian resistance factions
on their terrorist organization's lists. But it is very strange for some Arab countries to join these nations' efforts that are